We will
call the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. We'll have folks drifting in, I think, over the next few minutes, as I hope we do. And we're going to change the agenda a bit. We are going to take up the update on Business Oregon's business expansion program first, probably the future of transportation funding second, then the fee study report third, and the rail system last, to make sure we have Representative Nathanson here. So with that, Mr. Director.
Thank you.
Chair Bentz, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe. I'm director of the Oregon Business Development Department, also known as Business Oregon. I want to thank you for changing the agenda to accommodate my time. I need to get down to Eugene, so I appreciate that. I've given you a handout that explains the program. For those of you that weren't here, this goes over the criteria to qualify for the program, but to give you a little history on why this program was created, it dates back to when Governor Kulongoski was in office. We had an existing Oregon company come to us and told us they were looking to locate 200 jobs either in Oregon or up in Everett, Washington, and they wanted to know what the state had available as an incentive to help them do that. Well, it quickly became obvious to us the only really incentive we had based on something like that was the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, and it was a very small fund. So we really weren't able to do much for an existing Oregon company that had to make a decision on expansion, and that was the beginning of our thoughts on this program. So we crafted it around that. So you can see, if you look at the program eligibility, what you need to do to qualify for this, you have to be a company that's been in business and employing 150 more employees. We put that in because we wanted a company, not a company that's startup or somebody that's just getting ready to go, where this would act as venture capital. It has to be an established company. There had to be a minimum of 50 new hires and 150% of the average wage, whether it's the state wage or the county wage, whichever was lower. So there was some real stringent criteria, and it had to be a traded sector company, meaning manufactured goods that were built in Oregon and distributed throughout the world from Oregon. Now, what I've done on the program administration, I highlighted the third bullet down, which calls for the but-for clause, and this was the real key, that they would not be eligible for this if they weren't willing to say or this incentive wasn't the reason they came here. So they have to have said, without this, we would not have expanded or chosen to come to Oregon. And in every instance where we've applied this credit, it has been the deciding factor in their decision to either expand or locate in Oregon. So when the program was approved in the 2011-13 session, $4 million was allocated to the fund, not an exorbitant amount in my estimation. And to date, three companies have qualified for the program, creating 503 jobs at an average wage of $76,000 per year. That's $38 million in payroll and $2 million in personal income taxes to the state every year. And keep in mind, these figures do not include hundreds of job construction jobs that are a result of this program, nor all the revenue the state realizes prior to these companies being at full operation. So while they're getting up to scale, these construction jobs, all the employment that's going in to get them to the agreed-upon number of jobs, we're realizing revenue. I'm excited. During the first week of December, we're going to make another announcement. A company right here in Salem is going to employ 65 more people at an average wage of $75,000 per job. And we have four more projects pending that will far exceed the $4 million currently available to us. And in every one of the instances I've referenced, I want to say it again, we've been in close competition with other locations, and this program was a deciding factor in their decision to locate in Oregon. So during the 2013-15 session, the sunset date was lifted on this program, and the program has made a permanent part of our agency's budget, and I want to thank you for that. I think it's a very wise decision. And having said that, during the next full session, I'm going to come back and ask for more. That's just the way I am. You know? But when I ask for more, I want you always to keep in mind, we're making money. This is making money for the state. This is what we're all about. I didn't point out one of the instances here or one of the program administration clauses. We're giving them 2 years of estimated annual income taxes, personal income taxes, but we're requiring them to stay and hire these people for a minimum of 3 years. So not only are we getting our money back, we're getting an additional 50% on what we've invested. That's guaranteed. If they don't do that, they have to give us the money back. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Leibman.
Excuse me. So a couple of questions. First, you made the comment about the business, I'm trying to get this correct, being in business. But I don't understand, because it says a company has 150 more employees. We know companies start up and maybe in the third month have 150 employees. So I need to understand a little bit more what you mean by saying, they're in business long enough, or is there a time frame, or how do you decide, quote, they're in business?
Representative Lively, members of the commission, that's a good point. By that, I mean, what we're looking at is established companies. I don't believe, Paul, we have a criteria for how long they've been in business. But what we were trying to guard against, excuse me, I've had a cold. What we found is startup companies typically don't have 150 employees, mm-hmm. and we wanted to give a minimum, but we didn't want to be exclusive and say 2,000 employees,
sure.
Because there's very few of those. So we wanted it to be companies that had the potential to grow and become 2,000 employee companies, but not limited to those 2,000. So most companies, what we found is, are not willing to say that without this, we wouldn't have done this. So that is the real criteria.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the other question you talked about, so if they don't do it, they pay the money back. But again, we all know when companies fail sometimes, there is not. So I'm not clear on exactly, I don't assume there's a lien or anything with this money. And so what's the provision that actually assures the money back?
Representative Lively, members of the commission, that's a very good question. Again, we enter into a contract with them. Now we can't. Thank you very much. Bankruptcy is something that we can't guard against, but to give you an example, the companies that have taken advantage of this, Salesforce out of the Bay Area, hasn't been in business a long time, but a huge company employing thousands of individuals. Oracle, another one. Daimler Trucks North America. Excuse me. I don't think, I won't say with certainty, but I don't think these companies are about, in the next 3 years, about to go under. It's been our experience. We don't put this on the table with companies that we're not comfortable with, because we're not required to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool at our disposal. So unless we're very, very comfortable with the company and its ability to maintain and do what it said it's going to do, we won't put it out there. Sorry about this.
Further questions?
Thank you, Representative.
I have one, and it's more just kind of a perspective question, because this is not an area that I'm really up on. But, lots of states and counties and even cities give incentives for businesses either to expand or to relocate or whatever. Are there any statistics to prove that this really does help? Because I'm just trying to think of, for example, the Boeing situation up in the Seattle area, that the plants are there, everything else, and it's like, if we don't get this, then we're going to, go to North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so is this something that companies are willing to expend more capital to maybe get different facilities or whatever, or is this really is an incentive?
Yeah. Representative Doe, members of the commission, that's a very good question. In answer to that, yes, Daimler Trucks North America, we are in a very tight competition with South Carolina. Mm-hmm. They manufacture trucks there as well as here, and their customer base is in the Carolina. It's on the East Coast, if you think about the population, mm-hmm. trucks. The fact is, they wanted to be here, frankly. It was a unique negotiation. They wanted to be here.
Mm-hmm.
But when they put all the numbers on the table, the parent company is in Stuttgart, Germany. and they don't care South Carolina, North Carolina. So when it all came down to it, the last thing we put on the table was this. And without this, Daimler would say we'd be in South Carolina today. Mm-hmm. So is it necessary? I can't say 100% of the time, but in the Salesforce, Oracle, and Daimler, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Without it, they wouldn't be here. Okay. They wouldn't expand here.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Further questions? Oddly enough, I have several.
I might have Paul talk for me.
So I had an interview with a board, editorial board of a newspaper, and I was explaining some of these programs. And the editor of the paper said, well, that's just a subsidy, and how can you, as a good conservative, support a subsidy? And I said, well, perhaps, Mr. Editor, you don't understand the way the playing field is aligned today. And it strikes me that maybe most of us are not. And that goes to Representative Doherty's question. But for having this program available with a subsidy, we wouldn't have these businesses here. That's what you're telling us. So the question, though, is it a race to what? Where's the end of it? And I've asked you this question before over the years, but what ultimately is, I'm just curious, a cash incentive on top of a series of other things that ultimately got Daimler here. What was this truly, there must have been more. I'm just curious, what other elements are positive for us other than this just handing money out?
Representative Betts, members of the commission, I want to say this incentive is based on annual income that the state's going to realize as a result of it. This is money that's being given up front as a cash advance that the state gets paid back in personal income taxes over the two-year period, and every year thereafter, it's profit for the state. Our system of revenue is based on personal income taxes. What we've got here is incenting the companies to hire at 150% of the average annual wage. That, to me, is an incentive to locate here and employ people here. But the state's not out any money. We're not handing them something for free. It all comes back plus. So, to me, I guess the reporter's question is a good question, but the program isn't built around just giving them something that we're not getting something in return. We're getting hundreds of jobs in return at a much higher wage than being paid average across the state. So I just look at it as it's a program. To me, it's not like something we're just giving something away. We're getting something in return, and people are being employed as a result of it. I look at it, if you give them $2 million, I'll give you an example, and this was years ago, and we were in competition with Utah, and that governor put $80 million worth of incentives on the table that we couldn't even come close to matching, but there was no requirements. There was no contract. There was no return on that investment, no guaranteed return on that investment. So I think you need to look more closely that rather than it's a giveaway, they're being required to do something, or they don't get this. I don't know if that answers your question, but
well, it probably goes to the challenge we have in explaining what we're about to a broader scope of people across the state. And I had some folks visit my office yesterday who brought with them a proposed piece of legislation that would, in their opinion, impose transparency and openness and accountability and all of that. I said, well, I think we already have that. But yeah. I said, by some fortunate stroke, we have the director in front of us today, and I could ask that exact question. So from a transparency standpoint, if someone wanted to see how this worked and to see if the cash incentive, how closely it fit that return on investment, if you will, where can they look? Because that's what the reporter, what I would like to have done with the reporter is said, go on BizOrg web page and you can follow it right down and see how these pieces of this program work. And maybe that's there, I just don't know.
Representative Benz, member of the committee, that's a good question. I'll have to get back to you on that. We track it, and we track it through the employment department, the number of people they hire in that, and we hold it, and we enter into a contractual agreement with them, so we track it. Well, excuse me.
Could you?
Yeah. Representative and members of the committee, as Director McCabe noted, we track
your
that.
Name?
Oh, Paul Grove with Business Oregon.
Sure.
Apologies.
Thank you.
We track that information and verify it through the Employment Department, and then also work in consultation with the Department of Revenue to come and arrive at these estimates in terms of what the award is going to look at. As far as the reporting and the transparency aspect of that, I would have to get back with you in terms of, you know, what we do post on our website versus what's on the transparency website, but I think it's a very good point so that folks can indeed see what they are getting for the investment and what that return looks like.
Right. That part of being able to show how I feel like we're running a dog in the box here.
Mr. Chair, this turned into the health care committee.
So
that
element of return on the investment is hugely important because mm-hmm. when we do something that doesn't quite work out, we all get to read about it on the front of the Oregonian.
Right.
When it does work out, not so much. So where is it that we can find out the good that these dollars are doing?
Chair Benz, member of the committee, I'll get to that information. We provide that. I mean, we'll have it. Realize this is new. These companies are up and running. But I want to go back to something. I preface my testimony with an Oregon company coming to us, and I realized we had no incentives at that time. I want you all to know we have a lot of companies in this state that are being actively recruited mm-hmm. by other states and other communities. And we as a state, when they come to us, you know, we should have something to offer them when other states are putting hundreds of millions of dollars on the table. And I'm not exaggerating that. New York being one of them, they're very aggressive right now, as is Texas. And they are recruiting Oregon companies. And for our state not to have something to at least try to get them to stay here would be a mistake. And that's what this is. We're not giving them something without getting something in return. The money that Texas and California are putting on the table is they're betting on the long term, that they'll come there and stay there for a long time and they'll eventually get their money back. We're betting on the short term here. This is a 2-year agreement. You know, they have to do it in a 2 years. We're only giving them what we're going to get back in a 2-year period of time. So it's not as though we're out there gambling and we're requiring them to do what they say they're going to do. You know, so I... There's a lot of incentives that go out there, and most of them are done on a local level, the enterprise zones and others. The state really has very few incentives that itself puts up there.
If a person wants to check out to make sure that indeed these folks are being held to the terms of their agreement, how would they do that?
Ask us.
Right, but if they... is there a website they can go to and they can see that in 2013 we entered into, what, six agreements, five agreements, four? And each one has a set of criteria. Can they look and see that indeed the program eligibility requirements are being met? Because that was what the folks yesterday were asking that we pass legislation requiring.
Chair Benz, members of the committee, I think at present, I don't think this program is part of the overall transparency website, if you will. I think that might be what you're alluding to, if this was perhaps for inclusion on the transparency website. Like I said, I'm not certain that that's a part of the reporting requirement. I don't think we would have any trouble having that ultimately be a part of what's listed on the transparency website, so folks can indeed check to see the companies are indeed doing what they're doing and the state is realizing that return.
I don't think there's any... There's no doubt in my mind that when you tell me it's happening, it is. The trouble with it is I'd rather have it... more people know, more access to that information, so that the good that this program is doing is more widely known. To me, of course, I'm happy there's a link between our investment and the return on the investment within those 2 years. That's fine. But it seems to me that the other element we have to look at is the one that was raised earlier, and that is that we're in competition with all these other states that have apparently different measures of that return. And But for our putting this money up and getting up to a level or more level playing field, we as a state are in trouble, and it seems to me that we need to be doing a better job of explaining why we're engaged in this, and so that transparency piece might help. And again, I'm talking without knowing what you're already doing, so that's why I'm asking.
Right.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Yes, Reverend Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, you mentioned other states recruiting, looking at long-term versus our situation here short-term. So what happens in 3 years? Because we're focused short-term on programs like this, and you say other states are offering something to get them there, but they're betting on the long-term. What is it that they're doing that keeps somebody there long-term that we're not doing, that we have to come up with all these short-term solutions, in your opinion? What are you hearing?
Representative Cameron, members of the committee, when I say long-term, that they're putting exorbitant incentives on the table in the hope that when they accept them and they come to their state, they're going to come there for an extended period of time. They're not requiring it. Okay. And the difference, and when I say long and short term, we're requiring them to hire X amount of people, and we're requiring them to pay X amount of dollars. Those requirements aren't there in the other states. They're betting on the fact that they're just going to do that. When I say long and short term, they're hoping they're going to be there for a long time. They're not requiring it. What we're doing is we're requiring it here, that they be here the minimum of the 2 years agreed upon, and it's actually 3 years, so the state gets the return on its investment. That was what I meant by that.
So we
on
get
the
our,
long term.
So we get our money back, and some states may not. Is that kind of the bottom
some
line?
Some states don't. Representative Dory, members of the commission, we've seen other states, New York in particular, that put up a huge incentive to lure a portion of Intel away, a new spinoff from Intel. We did not actually go after it, and that company has closed its doors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a method to what we're doing here in established companies. I'm not saying Intel's not an established company, but a spinoff of Intel isn't an established company, and we're very prudent in the way we use what we've got.
I don't want to beat this, and this is something I would like to talk about a little bit later, but I appreciate the question that Representative Cameron asked, because this program, I think, is a good program. I think it works. But so what happens after that third year? So, again, companies, how do we keep companies, or what else do we need to do? I mean, we can't every 3 years, if they're going to hire 50 more people, give them another, or maybe we can, I don't know. But, I mean, so I'm still trying to understand, I guess, the business climate or what else it is that passed if we make this investment. Because we don't want them just here for the 3 years. We want them here for the long term.
Representative Lively and members of the committee, I couldn't agree with you more. There, we have nothing. This is... Okay. This incentive is strictly to help them grow here. It's something we didn't have before. There's no guarantee anybody's going to stay here. We're requiring it. When we give them the money up front, we're requiring it of them. But that's all. I mean, we can't. And realize, we're talking about $4 million here. I'm not talking $50 million or $100 million. We're talking about $4 million here. This is not an extravagant, exorbitant program. It's woefully underfunded, if you ask me. Again, the state gets its money back. This is not something we're just giving them something for nothing. And hundreds of people are getting high-paying jobs. That, to me, is a pretty easy concept to understand. Not that you don't, but in representative for a reporter, if they can't get that, you know, we're not giving them anything. Mm-hmm. We're giving them an advance to keep them here.
Yes, sir. One quick question. Two. First off, have other states done this in terms of the sort of plan that you're describing here for Oregon?
I haven't seen it anyplace else.
And it's a brand new, right?
It started in 2011, we introduced it in 2011-13. Yeah.
So we're getting close to having some companies that would have been here for the 3 years.
So now, what's happened there, they're getting up and running now. Salesforce has opened up their office, and they're almost up to the agreed-upon 205 jobs.
Okay.
So realize that they came on 5/14/2012. So they've been in operation all of this time since then, almost a year and a half, paying personal income taxes, but the clock hasn't started yet. The clock starts when they're at that 205 jobs. So all that construction money that to build their facility, the state's realized all of this revenue, but once they get to that number, then we start the clock. And they have to go an additional 3 years. So when I say we're getting our money back in 2 years, I'll tell you what, when Daimler sticks a shovel in the ground, they start building a six-story complex, employing thousands of construction jobs that don't count in this, we're going to have all of our money back in very short order. But they had we not done this, Daimler said, we're in South Carolina.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's
like
fine.
Eventually,
we're going to get to a point where we have some data about
absolutely
companies beyond 3 years. This is kind of what I was looking for. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry,
thank you.
And thank you for administering for my health problem.
The next item we'll take up is item two on the agenda, the future of transportation funding. I think we have Carmen Four. Yes, here she is. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon, Chair Benz, Vice Chair Gorsuch, and members of the committee. My name is Carmen Four, and I am the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Policy Advisor for Governor Kitzhaber. I appreciate you inviting me to come before your committee today to discuss our shared interest in the viability of our state's transportation system. For our state, a safe and efficient transportation system underpins a strong economy and healthy communities. It helps get goods to markets, move workers to their jobs, and create a desirable quality of life that attracts and retains talented people. Oregon's strong multimodal transportation system has been a comparative advantage for our heavily trade-dependent economy as we compete for jobs with other regions and seek to export products from our farms, our forests, and our factories. Significant investments by previous legislatures in both the preservation of our system and into strategic multimodal capacity expansion of the system over the past decade has left Oregon with a transportation network that better moves people and goods across all modes. This makes Oregon an attractive place to do business, particularly for businesses dependent upon exporting goods to national and international markets. And no matter how Oregonians choose to get around, if they either walk to school, drive to work, catch a train to visit for family visits, or bike to the gym, we want to make sure the system they travel on will get them there safely. But we do have some challenges going forward. The resources needed to operate, preserve, and improve the system are significantly constrained due to a number of factors, and let me just give you a few. First, for our surface transportation system. Our state highway fund, which is our primary source of revenue used to maintain our shared roads, bridges, and highways, is fully committed to maintenance, debt service, and agency operations. Because the user fee flowing into the funds are not indexed to inflation, little to no room is left to maintain the system we have today, let alone enhance capacity. Second, overall gas consumption has fallen from its high in 2006, reducing revenues into the state highway fund. And although it has stabilized, it has never recovered. Researchers say reductions in fuel consumption is partly due to the prolonged economic slowdown, ongoing challenges in the fleet to more fuel-efficient, in the fleet to more fuel-efficient and hybrid vehicles, and both an aging and millennial generation that are less inclined to drive. Another issue is that the funding the state receives from the federal government for its contribution toward our surface transportation system is in jeopardy. The Congressional Budget Office has recently reported it predicts the Federal Highway Trust Fund will become insolvent by the end of next year if Congress does nothing to address faltering transportation revenues. This is significant to Oregon because the Federal Highway Trust Fund represents nearly a quarter of the state's surface transportation budget, and going forward will represent virtually all of ODOT's construction budget. Another issue is that funding for non-highway investments in things like passenger rail and public transportation will continue to be limited due to a lack of sustainable funding for sources of these modes. And I also want to talk a bit about both aviation and marine. First, for aviation. Investments in our aviation infrastructure is limited because of a constrained fuel tax. Now, increasing this tax would help provide needed resources to maintain our state's general aviation facilities. And that's important specifically in rural communities because they rely on these airports both for economic benefit in their community. They also are important because they provide access for emergency service vehicles, especially during forest fire season. But increasing that fuel tax can also put the Portland International Airport and other commercial airports at a competitive disadvantage when competing for service from a highly competitive commercial airline system. As for our marine system, small ports along Oregon's coastline, almost without any funding for needed maintenance dredging until the state stepped in to fill in the gap of the disinvestment from the federal government. And if you'd like to go into that, I can explain more about that later. These constraints have left the state with inadequate resources to meet a number of transportation needs. And to start with that, let me talk a bit about some of the condition and resilience of our system overall. First, for our bridges. In 2003, ODOT identified $5 billion in bridge repairs and replacements throughout Oregon that were necessary. Bridge conditions in some cases were so bad that truck traffic had to be rerouted over mountain passes or through rural downtowns and small communities, creating excessive congestion in those communities and adding excessive cost to shippers who were trying to get their goods to market. Now, the legislature responded to this problem in 2003 when it passed OTIA 3. Funds from this legislation were targeted toward bridge repair and replacement, but those funds only address about a quarter of the identified need. And we will not be able to address the vulnerability of our system due to a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. The 2013 Oregon Resiliency Plan reported that the majority of bridge and other transportation infrastructure in western Oregon are susceptible to serious damage in a major seismic event because they were built before modern seismic codes were in place. ODOT's seismic option report does lay out three phases of work to make bridge repairs and unstable slopes on lifeline routes resilient in the event of a major earthquake. This will allow these key lifeline routes to survive an earthquake in order to help with emergency response in the short run, and in the long run, speed up economic recovery. An economic analysis found that the rate of return on these investments is 46 to 1, with the investments reducing the economic impacts of a major event by $84 billion. Now, as for our pavements on our shared system, due to limited resources, the condition across the state has steadily been declining over the last 3 years. Now, ODOT and many communities were able to do a lot of paving projects with one-time federal stimulus dollars, but funds for ongoing maintenance of these roads are limited. Deferring routine and preventative pavement maintenance simply means deteriorated pavement must be rebuilt rather than just resurfaced. And rebuilding pavement costs 3 to 5 times more than just maintaining it properly in the first place. And failed roads hit all of us in our pocketbooks. Studies show that maintenance costs for passenger vehicles and trucks increase with poor pavement condition. So consequently, we simply pay now to keep the pavement in good condition today, or we all pay more later for vehicle damage and increased rebuilding costs. All of our transportation agencies and local governments must concentrate their limited resources on preserving the existing system and making it safe. For multimodal funding, Oregon has no long-term dedicated funding to adequately improve and operate non-highway modes. Recent investments, though large, have been episodic rather than sustainable. For passenger rail, beginning this year, ODOT and WashDOT must cover the full cost of Amtrak's Cascade intercity passenger rail service between Eugene and Vancouver, B.C. Congress has prohibited Amtrak from contributing to regional service like they have always done in the past, placing a significant financial burden on states that have Amtrak service. And ODOT has assumed additional maintenance costs because it's purchased two new trains to preserve existing service. The only funding available for passenger rail service in Oregon comes from custom license plate fees and from taxes paid on lawnmower fuel. Funding is not available to continue the current Cascade service next biennium, let alone invest in better service that the Passenger Rail Leadership Council is currently working to identify. As for freight rail, while most consumer goods are transported by truck for at least part of their journey, freight railroad provides efficient long-haul and short-haul services that integrate closely with the trucking industry. The state's partnership with Freight Railroad allows us to increase shipping by rail while leveraging private dollars to improve the freight network in Oregon. This is an attractive investment because rail provides an economic alternative for some firms shipping long distances, and each ton shipped by rail emits 86% less greenhouse gas emissions and uses 62% less fuel when compared to trucks. For our public transportation system, statewide there are more than 40 transit providers, from big urban districts like TriMet to smaller districts like the Basin Transit in Klamath, as well as transit operations provided by the 9 federally recognized tribes. All of these transit authorities are struggling to provide adequate service and keep their vehicle fleets in good shape. Many of these transit authorities benefited from one-time federal funds to replace aging fleets, but they don't have ongoing funding sources for proper fleet maintenance and replacement. And across the state, providers have had to scale back service as local resources used to pay for operations have not been adequate to maintain service, in part due to the recession. Now, as for bicycling and pedestrian use, recent trends have shown that active transportation can play an important role in addressing our transportation challenges. Census data shows that between 2000 and 2010, walking in Oregon increased by 25% in both rural and metro areas, and biking doubled. About a third of respondents to a recent ODOT study indicated they would or might change how they travel to work if transit, biking, or walking facilities were added. However, a quarter of the people said they don't have a safe way to walk or bike to work in their community. And this is not an incorrect assessment. Both bicyclists and pedestrians are disproportionately likely to be victims of an auto crash. For pedestrian deaths, while they account for 14% of fatalities, but they only represent 4% of the trips taken in Oregon. So going forward and assessing all of our needs, what are the opportunities? Well, looking into the future, the state has the opportunity to step up to the challenges of maintaining and improving our shared transportation network. And key to this is that state leaders, stakeholders, and communities need to come together to come to consensus on what really is the need and begin looking at a range of funding options. Since the user fee that goes in the state highway fund is not indexed for inflation, it continues to lose its cumulative purchasing power over time. And making matters worse, construction costs have escalated significantly enough that it buys about half the concrete, steel, and other materials that it did 20 years ago. Now, there are a number of revenue tools that are potentially available to ensure that the revenue coming into the state highway fund keeps pace with the effects of inflation and fleet fuel economy. One option could be to consider indexing the state gas tax to both of these measures just to keep pace. Another option is to look at some of the state's driver's license and motor vehicle fees. Oregon has one of the lowest vehicle registration fees in the nation, and this and other fees could be looked at to see whether they should be increased to keep pace with peer states. And we also must keep an eye to the future. ODOT is working to investigate the viability of a VMT or the road usage charge to sustain the state highway fund when the gas tax is no longer sufficient. Now, so you are aware, some states have started to raise revenues through a percentage sales tax on gasoline in lieu of a fixed state gas tax. So as the cost of gas increases, more money flows into the state highway fund, but the volatility of gas prices also makes transportation funding subject to volatility as well. There are financing tools that can be helpful to leverage resources for strategic investments. Bonding remains a potential tool that can be used to make strategic and targeted investments in the state's transportation system. However, we need to be mindful of the existing debt currently carried by ODOT's budget and make sure that the taxpayers of Oregon would enjoy a sufficient rate on return from those bonded dollars. And we should also look at innovative project delivery and financing mechanisms like the I2O, Innovative Infrastructure Oregon, or the Partnership Oregon, or the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, which has the potential to bring private revenue to the table tied to innovative performance-based contracting. And the governor remains very interested in seeking adequate, dedicated, sustainable funding for non-highway modes as well. So let me stress, to be successful going forward, we need our decision makers, our stakeholders, and our community members to work together in partnership to determine investment priorities, what we are willing to pay for, and how we can raise the needed money. With your interest and willingness to engage, we can work together to develop a solution that can move Oregon forward. And with that, I'm done with my testimony and have you take any questions.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions?
Yes, Mr. Gorsuch. In terms of Amtrak service, is it possible, or is this governed by federal law, is it possible to have a nominal attachment to ticket prices that would help fund rail service in the state?
Chair Benz, Representative Gorsuch, I think that what you can get out of the ticket revenue does contribute in part to the service. I know you're also going to hear from Hal Gard later, who can speak more directly to that. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately you're going to have to be looking at the combination of what can you get at the ticket box in order to ensure that people are wanting to use the service, that it remains attractive, but then at the same time, what is that the subsidy component that needs to be in place in order to ensure the service is viable.
Which is very similar to mass transit, where you have that issue of fare box revenue versus subsidy.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Benz, thank you. Ms. Forrest, so nice to have you here. Thank you for your testimony. I just came back from a PennWorks conference up in Canada, and the topic of conversation for a couple of days was energy, particularly the burgeoning gas industry and how much natural gas will be available to not only their country but ours in the next not only decades but potentially centuries. And one of the conversations was about refueling vehicles with compressed gas, liquid natural gas. They're already moving pickup trucks up there that are co-fueling on compressed gas and gasoline or diesel, so they can run on compressed gas until they run out. And then when they don't have the infrastructure available to refuel, they can run on diesel until they get back to where they can refuel on gas. And the chicken or the egg question keeps coming up about retrofitting vehicles or the industry starting to change to the production of vehicles that run on co-fuel or on compressed gas. And has that been a conversation in your shop about how we incentivize either the industry to bring the infrastructure to make the fuel available or incentivize the industry to bring the vehicles available, which will drive the investment in compressed gas or natural gas fueling stations? Has that been part of the conversation?
Chair Benz, Representative McCowan, yes, there are conversations about how can CNG become more attractive, and a lot of that will be partly done in the marketplace, and you're hitting on the right component parts. When the vehicles become, straight out of the box, CNG vehicles become competitive, people will invest in them, but the other piece is that you have the fueling network available so people can access it and feel that they can travel around wherever they need to without, having having a break in service. And certainly there are explorations around how can we incentivize getting more fueling stations into the system, and that you get the added bonus of the efficiency and greenhouse gases as well. But there is an enormous amount of conversations as it relates to these alternative fuel sources and how we can get the state prepared, you know, for that kind of an infrastructure. And ultimately, you need that infrastructure as the backbone in order, you know, for the fleet conversion to occur.
It was very interesting to hear the one particular presentation dealing with the production of pickup trucks for the Canadian market coming out of some of our manufacturers down here, and they're beginning to design them and build them. So I think the day's coming. The question is, who's going to drive what? Is it the infrastructure? Is it the vehicle?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Yes, Representative Lavery.
Thank you, Chairman Bentz. So as you described kind of the challenges in that, one of the things that keeps going across my mind is the dollars, the total dollars, when we talk about all these different systems that are involved, and the ability of any one of those tools, and to set aside whether the federal government does or doesn't, I mean, that just changes the whole equation anyway. So is part of our conversation, or can part of our conversation be around a whole different way that we approach this, so it isn't incremental, a little piece here and a little piece there, that maybe there's another way? Because if you take the total number of dollars and just look at it, the number of citizens we have, the ability to pay it, I mean, it's a huge deal. So I don't know if there's some other direction that we can talk about it coming out there, or is it only incremental, and so we'll never get there, frankly, with the total amount.
Mm-hmm. Chair Bentz, Representative Lively, one of the things to remind us all is that Oregon is in one degree on the vanguard in terms of looking at what is an alternative funding mechanism, and that is as it relates to the VMT, the road user charge. And I will say that around the country, all eyes are on Oregon as that pilot program is moving forward, and certainly when I was still in Washington, D.C., everyone's looking very closely to that. And there is all truth in that states are going to have to lead in that effort, that the federal government won't leap to do that. Certainly we are currently making investments through a range of user fees as we pay to access the system. And over time, that's been sort of the historic compact in recent generations about how we finance our transportation system. But in large part, we're entering it by paying a user fee. I think moving forward, what we need to do is, what is the vision for the transportation network we want to have going forward? And as part of that, how do we really want to position both Oregon to be strategically competitive as we move goods and services around our state and to be competitive in our region, but then nationally and internationally, how do our transportation systems set us up to be competitive against peer nations? To rest assured, our competitor nations are making significant investments in their transportation systems right now, in part because it puts people to work today and provides a lot of good jobs for companies and people in their countries, but also it makes them very competitively attractive in order to get goods and services moved. The United States is a very large country, and we have to look at those transportation networks as a whole. So as we plan for a state, we want to be mindful of that. But I think we can and we should be innovative in how we think about moving freight around and how we move people around. To be certain, some of these investments are expensive, but they're not investments that we'd make all today, and we should continue to absolutely maintain the system we have and then start strategically positioning ourselves to make those future forward investments to better move people and goods around.
Thank you.
Other questions? So you and I had the opportunity to appear before the counties just a couple of days ago with Representative Reed and Senator Beyer and Senator Starr. And we got to listen to the county commissioners' concerns about funding their county roads.
Mm-hmm.
And I pointed out that in my driving back and forth across the state, the state highway system is in relatively good shape. In fact, I would say it's in excellent shape, and proving need when you can zoom from Ontario to Salem, nary a pothole to be seen, is difficult. And what it requires, and I recall when Governor Kulongowski brought the transportation package proposal back in 2009, is a great deal of gubernatorial leadership. And I find, looking at the American Society of Civil Engineers report card for Oregon, we get a C- when it comes to transportation. And then the gentleman engineer that wrote this gives us a series of 8 recommendations. number six of which reads, exploring and developing innovative infrastructure funding and increasing leadership at all levels of government. Since you're representing the governor today, I'm happy to hear your remarks regarding looking forward. But what can we anticipate from your office when it comes to recommending what we should be doing? Because it does take all levels of leadership to make such things as paying more tax happen. So,
absolutely. I think the governor is certainly interested in visioning forward what kind of a transportation system we want to have moving into the 21st century. And I think in part why you were successful with the JT effort in 2009 is you had broad involvement from stakeholders and community leaders all across Oregon who articulated what the need was, but that at the same time committed toward the investments we wanted to make. And similarly, I think the governor is very interested in ensuring that we have a broad and diverse conversation and we're looking at all modes. And again, what do we need to do today? What incremental steps can we be making to, you know, kind of leap some of our modes forward? But then how do we position ourselves to really be making strategic investments in different kind of transportation networks that will really position Oregon well throughout the rest of the century?
Right, and that raises an issue. I actually mentioned it in the previous committee meeting, where the egalitarian approach to funding things, the analogy was spreading peanut butter across the entire state about this thick, which is great for Burns, Ontario, John Day, my part of the world, but maybe the ROI, the return on investment, would be far better if we put all that peanut butter in Portland or Coos Bay or someplace where something is actually going to give us a greater return. The numbers actually are very discouraging when you look at the decline in ROI over the past 20 years. Going from roughly, actually 50 years, going from roughly 20% ROI down to 1%. So this so-called strategic investment is just a euphemism for not giving rural counties the money. And I'm being harsh, but the ROI in rural counties is far less generally than that what it might be in Portland. So how would the governor go out into my part of the world and say, surprise, we need to have your money, we're going to invest it where we can generate a lot more of a return?
Chair Benz, I thank you for those remarks, and I appreciate them because I spent a lot of time working in a congressional district that's vastly rural. I think one of the things that I made note of in my remarks is what we lose as a state in terms of cost when we don't maintain our system, that it is exponentially more expensive to go back and do wholesale repair than just do ongoing maintenance work. The other piece that's hugely important, specifically in rural communities, is that we're making adequate investments into transit services. And this is hugely important as we're trying to ensure that people can get themselves to work, and also for seniors living in these communities, that they don't become isolated in place, because once they get to the place where they're less likely to drive or less comfortable to drive, and in some instances not able to drive, that they're trapped in communities that they choose to live in. We were having these conversations as we were watching passenger rail service from Portland into eastern Oregon fall by the wayside, and that was one of our huge concerns. And but I think when you're looking at all these services overall, you really have to make that commitment to maintaining the system as we have today, because it is much more cost effective, providing services in communities to ensure that people can get around to do the things that they need to do, go to the doctor's visit, go to the grocery store, get to a job. But at the same time, we are going to have to look at in our urban core where we have congestion, and it impacts the economic viability of our state as we're trying to get goods into the Port of Portland to export them out or move freight traffic throughout the state, that we're not so bottlenecked in other places that we're unable to move goods and services. All that being said, is I think we have to have an eyes open and honest conversation with Oregonians about what we get with our shared investment in these resources. I just don't think there's any other way to do it. It is to be honest about what those needs are and what individuals want in their home communities, but at the same time how our shared wealth and destiny really are tied together.
The challenge, of course, is being able to remind people of the importance of the transportation system that you just mentioned and the fact that we have to pay for it. And the almost entitlement mentality sometimes suggests that someone else will pay, like the federal government. But as those dollars dwindle, then the need to be more careful, strategic in how they're invested becomes greater. So the question again is, what's the overall approach to this increased leadership? Because, again, I think it's the governor governor's kind of out there in front, or should be, if any of this is going to happen. So again, I'm really asking for a more detailed response. You've just started, and so I'm not expecting the thick report we worked from in 2009, which was, I think, a product of 2 years' work.
Agreed, yeah.
Which we then got to build on in moving forward. Do you anticipate a similar effort in the next year or so?
Yeah. Chair Benz, the answer to that question is yes, and we're getting prepared and ready to start a similar process. But to be certain, there are a few more steps to go. But the goal really is to do a similar process, to have that broad constituent and stakeholder involvement and legislative leader involvement and elected officials from all levels. What I've heard consistently from folks since I've been back to Oregon is that process was effective. People felt they had a good voice in that process. And they'd like to revisit and reuse that process again. I just need to have time to get that process up and going.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
I want to go back to a statement you made about the bridge need in the state of Oregon. Was it $5 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Did that ODOT estimate include non-highway? In other words, was it also county bridges?
I don't have the exact answer to that, but I can get back to you.
Okay, because we know if it doesn't, we know then that there's actually an even greater need. You look at some of the bridges in East Multnomah County. It's the Stark Street Bridge on the Sandy is inadequate, and that's being kind. And it's had several incidents where large trucks have actually run into the bridge trying to cross it. And we just had another scare that perhaps that bridge was damaged because a semi tried to turn onto it and it didn't fit. So I hope that we, it was a great move. I hope that we're able to, as Representative Benz was saying, remember too that the local infrastructure is frequently kind of forgotten, and we focus a lot on the highway and the freeway, which we need to. But there is that other component. And then one other little thing, if I could. Years ago, we lost the Pioneer Service, which you alluded to just a minute ago. And then there was some interest a few years back of perhaps trying to resurrect that. Now, we already face challenges with Cascades. Is there any discussion going on right now about Pioneer?
Representative Benson, Vice Chair Gorsuch, I don't know right now. A few years back when I was still working for Congress, I was meeting with Amtrak, and they were looking at the service that they provide across the country in different train routes, and certainly that would have provided service into Oregon. I have not had conversations with Amtrak recently about that service. And some of that's in part to the relationship and the situation that was going on between Amtrak and Congress in this last Congress and their funding overall, but we can certainly, I can check into that and get back with you.
Thank you. Representative McKeon.
Thank you, Chair Benz and Co-Chair Gorsuch for opening the door to bridges. I have a hard time letting that go by without mentioning that it's not just highway bridges that we need to worry about. We have a whole plethora of rail infrastructure mm-hmm. that have bridges that are a century old that are going to need ongoing repair for decades to come. So just want to make sure that we don't lose sight. It was just not highway bridges.
Absolutely. Further questions? See none. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the next item on our agenda is the Oregon Department Motor Vehicles Fee Study Report. Tom, Amy, and John. Do you want to go to this one? Tom, wait. So, I guess 30 minutes, 20 minutes, because I don't want more time. 20 minutes, right. Yeah, 20 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Benz and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation, today representing the DMV. I'll start out by saying we are here at the invitation of Chair Reed to talk about the findings of a study that DMV conducted with outside oversight and guidance to better understand its costs, to inform whether fees for the products that DMV sells, what they are and what revenues are going to the highway fund. And I'll diverge from my prepared remarks just a moment to refer to what Carmen Foer was saying just before us, and this seems to me to be a very sort of discreet, practical follow-up to her testimony. And the reference that stakeholders and policymakers need to be engaged and active, they also need to be informed. And so we really consider this to be a piece of important information for you to have in terms of where DMV's fees and costs are and how that relates to the highway fund. So backing up from that, just a little bit of sort of background about DMV fees and the highway fund. DMV obviously has several purposes. We issue driving privileges. We promote driver safety. We help to protect ownership interests in vehicles. But also DMV is charged with raising money for the highway fund. In effect, we have to turn a profit. So that the highway fund is directed by the Oregon Constitution, goes to the construction, repair, maintenance, operation, and use of public highways. So to raise money for the highway fund, historically most of DMV's products were sold or priced rather to cover costs. And then a few products, typically vehicle title and registration, were priced above costs, and the difference would go to the highway fund to build and repair roads and that sort of thing. So at the most basic level, DMV needs to ensure that it is covering its costs at least, and then raising money on top of that to put that money into the highway fund. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. McClellan to get into some of the details.
Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator. Just over a year ago, we initiated a fee study. I formed a team internally. It was not driven by legislation or any external request. It was my own decision. But I thought we needed to take a look at our costs and the fees that we charge and whether we're covering those basic charges, those costs that a business should be covering. It had been many years since that had been really looked at in depth, comprehensively. And so we formed that team to take a good hard look. I know this is not an exciting topic, cost accounting and fees and things like that, but I'll try to cut to the core to, as far as the some key findings and some recommendations that came as a part of that. We had some good solid staff internally to do this study, but we looked outside ourselves as well to get some insights and some review by some people who are more expert in this type of work. We pulled in some people on an advisory committee who were more familiar with this type of work. Part of that team that we pulled together included Willamette University's Institute for Modern Government, Willamette's Atkinson School of Business, which is right across the street here, the Legislative Fiscal Office. We had some people that work with numbers a lot and were very comfortable with it. We brought them in to look at our methodology and to assess the approach we were taking. Was it something that would withstand some critique in the future? And also, was it something we could replicate fairly easily in the future so I didn't have to bring in a lot of experts as we proceeded? A member of that group, who's our advisory committee, was John Rather. I'd like to, at this point, give him a chance to say a few things about his experience as an advisory committee member.
Thank you, Tom. Chair Benson, members of the committee, my name is John Radford. I'm the a former state controller here in Oregon. I'm here representing the Institute of Modern Government under the Center for Public Policy at Willamette University, which is head by Dr. Fred Thompson. I'm chair of the board of the Institute of Management of or the Modern Government. I just can't tell you enough how pleased we are that Tom and the management team undertook this project, and really pleased that he undertook the project with a sense of reaching out and utilizing a methodology, a cost accounting practice, which, by the way, is exciting to me. And he using the activity-based costing method, which is commonly referred to as ABC or ABM, activity-based management or activity-based costing. It's a methodology which has come to be out of the 1960s as the country was transitioning from a manufacturing environment to a service-based economy. Yet the principal guidelines under the accounting standards or structure seeks to identify activities or business processes and understand the structure of those costs, and then link those with drivers of those costs. So you have the relationship between what activities are being conducted from a direct cost standpoint and from an overhead standpoint, and then how those costs are driven by cost drivers. And then further, understanding those two relationships with prices for products and services. So it's kind of a complete picture there. This is used in a number of different ways. They can be used for capital allocation, cost allocation, inventory valuations. It can be certainly used for cost management, cost containment, and performance management purposes. So really pleased that Tom and the management team use this methodology. Very common in business. It's out there for anybody to see and use. Business uses it quite frequently. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I'm impressed with how the team approached the project from an independent, unbiased, and objective standpoint. There was clearly no indication that they had preconceived notions on where the numbers were going to come out. They applied assumptions based on this methodology, and the numbers came out where the numbers came out. And so I was really pleased to see that. I mean, we had numerous conversations about how the work that they're doing is really simply being an information broker, bringing the best independent, unbiased, objective analysis they can to the policymakers for decision-making around what is normally a very political charged process of increasing fees or changing fee structures. So really pleased to see that. So with that, I just want to tell you how pleased we are. We thought the process worked really well. I'll just say that if you have any questions, simple questions, I'd be happy to answer. Any complex questions, I'd defer to Tom.
I'll proceed at this point. Thank you. Some of the key findings from the study, I really do want to boil this down to the high points. Finding number one, a number of our fees are set below the cost to provide that product or the service. And I'll give you two examples that I think are indicative of that. The fee for an original commercial driver license skills test, which can take us 2 to 3 hours to administer. So that's with the driver, with the truck, out on the road, determining if the person can operate the vehicle and knows how to operate it, you know, successfully. We currently charge $70 for that test. The study determined a fully loaded, you know, cost for that activity for us to do is closer to $295 per test. It's worth noting that third-party testers, which we really are encouraging to happen, to be used in the state, are charging about $165 per test. We're basically undercutting the third-party, you know, private providers and not even covering our costs with a fee that's set in statute. And it's worth noting almost all of our fees are set in statute. You completely control how much we're going to charge for these services. So that's one example. Another example is the fee we charge to reinstate someone's driving privileges. So someone who's been suspended one or more times for various reasons will pay a fee to be able to reinstate their driving privileges so they have valid, active driving privileges. We currently charge $75 for a person to reinstate. When we looked at the total cost associated with all that, you know, entering information on a person's driving record and sending them notices and hearings and things like that, it was closer to $172 per reinstatement. So significantly priced below what we determined would be our cost for that activity as a group. So that was a first finding for us, and we've got a number of other examples that eventually we'd like to share with you. But today we're not asking you anything. It's more to inform you what we've found from the study. Second item, the general contributions to the State Highway Fund from DMV revenues is declining. And I say general because if you look at the amount that we are collecting actually on behalf of the state's transportation system, it's much higher than it used to be. Because of things like the Oregon OTIC, travel information, OTIA, in 2001 and 2003, and the Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009 definitely raised our fees. But those really were dedicated for specific purposes, for bridge replacement. You were just talking about that a moment ago. Highway improvements, maintenance of roads, but project-specific things, those fee increases were largely dedicated for those purposes, not because our costs may have changed over time. So most of those fee increases, we have had fee increases, but they have not been for that purpose. Consequently, as our costs over time have risen, the amount of unrestricted funding for the state's transportation system, including local governments, has declined over time and is predicted to decline even further. I think that's a significant finding from this study. Page 4 of your materials have a graph. Just explain it real quickly for you if you have that handy. The top green line shows our net revenue. So that's after our costs have been taken off. Some of the dedicated revenues, like for driver education, we collect a $6 fee for driver ed in the state. Other fees for senior disabled transit, all those things were taken off the top, just kind of the net revenue that we take in. That's that top green line. So you can see it's grown over time. But the components of that are the OTIA 1 and 3 and the Jobs and Transportation Act. That's the bars that you're seeing there that are the large pieces of it. The piece I want to draw your attention to is that lower bar, that in light blue. That's the net that's not attributed to those previous acts. Does that make sense? That's I think an important finding from this study, that the general kind of unrestricted funding that we're collecting for the state's transportation system has slowly eroded, and the other increases in a way have masked that. We really hadn't unveiled this until we dug into the numbers a little bit more closely. The third major finding, I think, is that we took a look at modes of service delivery. So like a vehicle registration renewal, you can do that in a number of ways today. You can do it at DEQ if you're in an emissions testing area. You can do it online. You can do it by mail. Or you can do it in a field office. And we determined that if you go to a field office, which is a more labor-intensive way to provide the service, it's about $6 more for that transaction than if a person chose to do it by mail or online. We'd love to see more people doing them online because it is just so much more efficient. But that basically erodes, again, that overall contribution because people are choosing to go with a different channel, and we charge the same amount no matter how you renew the registration. So I think it's an interesting finding as we looked at the study. Some potential actions or recommendations that may come to you. First is the fee changes that we looked at and identified from the study could potentially raise $40 to $42 million per year more, just if you looked at trying to recover the costs. And those are mostly on our driver licensing, driver privilege, driver program type activities, trying to get the money to cover that set of activities and programs that we're responsible for. A second potential action would be a surcharge. When you look at that difference in the cost in a field office versus other methods of renewing a registration, we could charge a surcharge, a convenience fee, if you will, for people who choose to do that transaction in a field office. I believe we have the authority in statute to do that if we do this type of a study. I just would personally not want to do that without conferring with you before I did that, because I think some people would react to that. But it is one of the potential things that could be done as far as noting the difference in cost of those two different modes. A third possible action that we identified, I instructed the team to look for ways that we could pay for potentially a significant investment in our computer systems at DMV. Long overdue, very old systems. But what have other states done? How have they paid for those big investments of could be as much as $90 to $100 million over 9 or 10 years? What we found was some states created dedicated funds for their technology. We don't have anything like that in Oregon today. But they created a fund, and they assessed a surcharge for some period of time, maybe $2 or $3 on top of those transactions, with that money going toward a dedicated fund to be drawn from for that investment in the computer systems. Because of the study team doing that kind of research with other states, we found that as an option. It's not necessarily the only way to pay for those types of investments. It could come straight from the highway fund, general highway fund money. But I offer that as a potential to help offset the cost of the, or to cover the cost of the investment in technology. it is something we need to do. And I don't want to dig into it too deep here today, but it is something we have started with some money that this body has provided to us to start doing some planning and strategically looking at our computer systems longer term, what needs to be done there. So in summary, we identified several fees that are significantly below the cost of production. The cost to deliver the products have risen, while some of the fees to pay for them have remained static for years. Fees for increases for the designated purposes have in some ways masked that deterioration of general contribution to us. But part of our role as a state agency is to generate money for the state's transportation system. And I just want to make sure that you understood that and recognize that, and we certainly take that on as an important responsibility for us. The final page of your document, the testimony there, has some comparisons to other states. This was not part of our study, but it's more just a piece of information for you. As we looked at other border states and other, you know, who's high and who's low as far as title costs and registration costs. What this points out to me is that Oregon's title fee of $77, while it might feel like a lot to you, it wasn't too long ago it was $10 for a title, so it is $77. It does rank 37th in the country. You just look at $77. We're more than Nevada and California, but we're significantly below Washington and Idaho as you look at this chart. Our registration fee at $43 per year, it's a two-year registration, it's 86, but 43 per year, is ranked 43rd in the country. Oregon is the lowest of its border states, those around us. But thing to recognize when you look at these is that many states have sales taxes, excise taxes, use taxes, ad valorem taxes, year and weight type fees that are added on top of kind of a base fee. And Oregon does not have those types of things, which is great, I guess, you know, from a consumer standpoint. But that's what you're seeing as you do see these comparisons. Some are over $2,000, you know, per year. This is based on this study was done in July of 2012, so it's about a year old. It's based on a 2012 Chevy Malibu being purchased brand new. So we had to pick some, you know, kind of standard vehicle at a certain weight. So the ways we checked with other states who have such different ways of calculating titles and title and registration fees, that we at least could give them that information. They could tell us this is what you would have to pay in our state. So it's as close as we can get to apples and apples in comparisons on those fees. But like I said, it was not part of our study, but we thought it would be useful for you. It's just kind of background information to have. That's all from the testimony.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes,
Mike. So, yeah, this is great information. So I understand that the fee is set by statute, but the assumption I'm making, and I don't know about history of this, when they started setting fees, the assumption was the cost would be covered by the fee. Is that, do we know if that's where this whole system started, regardless of the fact that it's fixed by the statute? I mean, was the precursor when we started down this path that at least the cost would be covered?
Chair Bentz, Representative Lively, that's actually a fairly difficult question to answer, as we've really been pulling away historically at the purpose and the original fees. But what we found was the vehicle title and registration fees, mostly the registration fee, was designated as the tax, basically, that we would collect. It would be the revenue-generating fee that we collect would be the registration fee. With all other services that we provide being cost recovery. We went back to some budget notes in the 70s from Ways and Means that led us to that belief that we were expected to do some cost studies periodically to ensure that our fees were covering costs. When you can kind of infer that when you look at the Oregon Constitution and show that our fees are expected to generate some revenues after our costs are recovered. So it's not as cut and dry as you might think. You look to a statute says this is the way it's going to be.
But just so I understand, so if you do a cost analysis, we do a cost analysis and show it doesn't, it still takes legislative action to change the statute in order for that to go up. I mean, yes. Carmen made the comment about indexing and those things. None of that's part of
Chair Benz, Representative Lively, we have a few fees that are set by rule, but almost all are by statute. None are indexed to any kind of cost of living or anything like that.
President Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today. Appreciate it. Tom, you mentioned that on the CDL test, that your cost, your hard cost, was $295. You charge $70, but third-party vendors do it for $165. Mm-hmm. How are they being reimbursed for their...
Representative Chair Benz, Representative Cameron, we do not cap what they can charge. They're under contract basically as agents to us to do third-party testing or in different areas around the state. They set their own fees.
So I would imagine they're a for-profit business?
Yes.
So they're only charging $165 and they're making money doing it, and your cost is $270? Can you explain why your cost is $130 more than a private vendor?
Chair Benz, Representative Cameron, a big chunk of what you're looking at in our costs on an hourly basis of the employee are those overhead costs of being part of state government. And we have fully accounted for all of our costs that are part of being a state agency. So running the state data center, the infrastructure of Department of Administrative Services, our central services at ODOT, all those costs, all those revenues that are associated with support of being a state agency, we have loaded onto the hourly cost of our employees in doing this study. And that's why you see something like $295 for a CDL test that takes 2 to 4 hours to complete.
So why would we not stop issuing CDL tests because it's costing you money and just allow them all to go to third-party vendors, privatize it?
Chair Benz, Representative Cameron, about two-thirds of the CDL testing in the state is already done by third parties, and we are gradually moving that direction. I find that some legislators really want us to provide CDL testings in their communities.
Yeah, they like to spend money unnecessarily, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
It wasn't a question.
I don't think there's a question there.
No.
Yes.
I guess my follow-up comment to Representative Cameron would be, if we can assure that there's a third-party vendor in every rural community, we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it may come down to the fact that geographically... how many vendors are going to be in smaller communities? I don't know.
Representative McEwen, that is definitely a consideration, that government frequently steps in where the private sector cannot make a profit, chooses not to. We're actively expanding on those third-party providers wherever we can to expand the coverage in certain areas. But it really is up to them to make the business decision. Is there enough work in a particular community to offer that service? And frequently taking their own truck and their employee to those locations traveling around the state.
But I do understand Representative Cameron's point, though. There's a sweet spot in there somewhere where, you know, the cost of government comes down and the cost of the private sector goes up and meets, and we provide the service. So not quite sure where that is, but it's there somewhere.
Further questions? Just a couple. Based on our conversation yesterday, when I very much appreciate you coming by and sharing this with me, then the I think it's the bottom of page two. There's a suggestion that money could be saved if we did everything online, and we discussed the possibility of giving people the choice of online or offline, mm-hmm. and those that wanted to stand at the counter would pay more, a surcharge. Mm-hmm. And what is the argument against reducing the charge, leave it the same at the counter, but reduce the charge for using online? What's the thought there?
Chair Benz, the net result of that would be a reduction overall of revenue to the state transportation system to just offer less. We don't currently have that statutory authority to do that, to offer a discount. If the registration fee were to go up at some point, I would encourage some consideration of a lower fee being allowed, so people wouldn't have to pay that full increase, the higher fee that might be charged for a online or an in-person service, and just provide a discount. I don't have currently that authority to do that in statute. But it's an alternative, and I think communication-wise, it probably plays better with the public. You know, I can spend less in one way if I just do it that way, versus being more punitive, I guess.
Well, I'm trying to get to the point of the matter that I'm going to say it the way I understand it, and you can correct me. what it appears is happening is that we have services that are being provided for something less than their cost. And then when we develop an efficiency, such as a computer system, that can provide a service for less, we're already so far in the red, we don't dare allow that efficiency to be passed on because we're already short of money. So thus, we just use the efficiency as an opportunity to collect more. In other words, the efficiency accrues to the state to cover the shortfall that you're describing for us. Yes. Is that a correct statement?
I think that, Chair Bell, I think that would be a
muddled
fair way
though,
to
maybe.
Describe that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other part, it goes in, it kind of follows on Representative Cameron's remark about the excess cost of some of the services compared to the private sector. The question is, when you look at those cost components, as we discussed yesterday, there's some of those that you're kind of stuck with. You're not really in a position, for example, to go reduce the contract wages of all or salaries or benefits that have been negotiated for those who work for the DMV. That's done by DAS. So you used then those fixed costs in bringing us this material. It's not a situation where we can say, well, why in the world didn't you reduce those costs? You would say, yell at DAS. Is that the proper way of interpreting this?
Mr. Bence, I'm not here to throw anybody under a bus.
No, sure.
We are.
Chair Bence, if I could, for just a moment, and after our conversation yesterday, you know, we looked at some other items, and, you know, and DMV has attempted to reduce costs and taken steps to affirmatively reduce costs. You know, between 2000 and 2012, there's been an 8% increase in the number of licensed drivers, an 8% increase in the number of passenger vehicle registrations, so a pretty big increase in the volume of things, and coincidentally an 8% decrease in FTE at DMV over the last, you know, 13 years. So you've got fewer people doing more work more efficiently, presumably. So those are some things that are going on. And then other items are, you know, the world's just gotten quite a bit more complex for the work that's done at DMV, with things like legal presence and any number of other things that have occurred over the last 13 years.
And that was a very good point yesterday, and I'm happy you reminded me of it today because I think it's an excellent point. The question is, why isn't it in here? Or maybe it is. I just haven't read it quickly enough. But that increased productivity, hugely important that everybody understand that's happening, because that's probably the best argument for many of us. So perhaps in the next report we could, and maybe it's in here, so I apologize. But that's a big deal. So further questions? See none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the last but not least item on our agenda is addressing choke points in the state rail system. We have five folks. We'll have
start with the first two.
Michael and Hal.
Do a panel.
Okay. Michael and Hal first.
Chair Bence, member of the committee, members of the committee, excuse me, I caught what Director McCabe came up here with earlier.
Do you expect the same treatment?
If I'm lucky enough. Members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I'm the administrator of ODOT's Rail and Public Transit Division. With me today is Michael Rock, and he is the project manager leading our state rail plan development. So I was asked to come here today and talk a little bit about rail bottlenecks. And There we go. And basically, I'm going to attempt to describe what they are. A bottleneck, really, on a freight line, unlike highways, where you have individual lanes for directional traffic. Railroads, you basically have two-way traffic on any single track. Even on a double-track railroad, you have rail going in two directions simultaneously. A bottleneck is any constraint that impedes the ability of traffic to move through any area, and that constraint can be either physical or can be temporal, and I'll provide some examples as I go through here. One of the most common bottlenecks that we face here in the state are junctions. So those are locations where any rail routes converge, diverge, cross at grades, and they're notorious for causing delay. and that's particularly the case when rail traffic increases. But even relatively lightly traveled track, a junction of some type can cause a delay anytime you have two trains vying for the same space in an area. So some notorious bottlenecks that we have here in the state are in East Portland, our North Portland Junction, Peninsula Junction, and the junction in Vancouver, Washington. So track-caused bottlenecks occur just because of any kind of reduction in track capacity or by speed restrictions. So for an example, in the 183-mile stretch of Burlington Northern track that runs from Vancouver, Washington to, or essentially from Portland to Seattle, that is a double-tracked section of railroad for the entire route, with the exception of a 2-mile section around the Nelson Bennett Tunnel. And as you can imagine, you've got two tracks with trains fully utilizing that whole area. When they come to that 2-mile section, it is creates a notorious backup and is the cause of a great deal of delay, particularly for our passenger lines. An example of a speed restriction is the Harrisburg Bridge on the UP line, and that is an area where the UP has done investments up and down that line. It's classified for 70 miles an hour and 79 miles an hour for passenger trains, 70 miles an hour for freight. Harrisburg Bridge reduces that to 30 miles an hour in that area. Yard bottlenecks are also an area where we frequently see constrictions, and that is really a result of yard capacity and how busy the railroads are. And there are times when those yard conflicts can be so enormous that they can affect rail traffic for hundreds of miles in either direction as sidings are used up waiting for the congestion within a yard to clear. And finally, a temporal bottleneck. Best example we have here in the state is on the West Commuter line. Mm-hmm. So there are numerous commuter trains using the P&W track in that area to a degree where freight trains are not able to move through that area during commuter times. And so all the freight movements are really restricted to the night hours and weekends in that area. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Michael.
Thanks, Alf. You wouldn't mind advancing the next slide, please?
Sorry.
No problem. Good afternoon, Chair Bentz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Rock, and I'm currently serving as ODOT's project manager for the Oregon State Rail Plan update. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss some of the ways that bottlenecks are actually coming into play and being considered as part of this larger update on the Oregon State Rail Plan. The State Rail Plan is a comprehensive policy and strategy document. It establishes the State of Oregon policy strategies and helps guide public investment decisions for the rail system. It is not, however, a specific list of projects, and I'll talk a little bit later on about some of the reasons why that is. The rail plan is an element of the multimodal Oregon Transportation Plan, same as our Oregon Highway Plan, our newer Freight Topic Plan, among others. And so this is refining sort of the broad policy direction for the rail system overall. The plan update is being led by a steering committee. It's made up of representatives from Class 1 and Short Line Railroads, Amtrak, TriMet for commuter rail considerations, local government representatives, port districts, shippers, and other interested stakeholders that are bringing environmental or economic development or labor group interests into the conversation. The steering committee is part of a larger public process that will ultimately include a statewide review and public comment period for the draft state rail plan. This will lead to hopefully adoption by our Oregon Transportation Commission and acceptance by the Federal Railroad Administration. And that's a little bit unique for one of our statewide plans to have that Federal Railroad Administration acceptance. But it's important for this project in particular because that will allow us to demonstrate that we have a PREIA, which is the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act, compliant state rail plan and positions Oregon for future Federal Rail Administration money moving forward. So that's an important aspect of this work. The information, if you can go back just for a sec, Hal, sorry about that. The information that's shown on the last slide. It's some really high-level policy elements from the draft plan to date, and we don't have a complete draft published yet, but we've been working with our steering committee on a lot of these elements and these policy discussions over the last several months. I'm going to just hit a couple of these really quickly. The first and foremost for our group has been talking about partnerships and collaboration, and one of the reasons that it's difficult for us to have project lists in the state rail plan is the rail system is predominantly a private system, and we recognize that for our plan development. We recognize it for the policies. And our group has said, you know, we really need to understand that we're talking about partnerships for a public role here. Connected system is important, whether that be geographic or regional connectivity or multimodal connectivity to transit or to ports, facilities, that type of thing. State of good repair and preservation. I think we heard actually from Carmen Forrest's comments about some of the preservation elements for the rail system. So that's important for our work as well. There's a number of policy elements around funding and finance and investment decisions, and we do talk about bottlenecks as being an important element of that, and I'll talk about that more in a second. Safety, you know, pretty self-explanatory, the importance of safety on the rail system, whether that be for users or commodities or the communities that the rail system is moving through. Quality of life in terms of environmental opportunities, some of the environmental benefits that rail movements can provide, but also the integration, again, with communities and some of the impacts there. And then finally, I wanted to point out economic development, because while economic development is inherent in really all of these policy areas to some extent, our group felt that the rail is important enough where it deserves the economic attributes called out at the highest level of the plan in our goals, and I wanted that to not be sort of buried in the policy. We're calling that out specifically. Digging in just a little bit deeper around some of the investment considerations, so these elements come into focus, and if you look at where our draft policies and strategies are today, you'll see these themes. Recognizing the importance for addressing Class 1, which is the mainline system bottlenecks, that's primarily where those are located. It's really an efficiency strategy for the system, and there's a good return and benefit for doing that. For our smaller railroads, short lines, we're primarily talking about the highest need being preservation for the most part, bridge, track, and others. Hal had mentioned terminal and rail yards and how that functionally serves as another type of bottleneck, and so there's some investment considerations for that in the plan. Consolidation facilities as well in terms of you know, transload facilities and bring commodities to be assembled and moved on the rail system. And then finally, shared use corridors, investments that we make that can benefit rail, freight rail, passenger, and even commuter rail. Obviously, that's an investment that can have a high rate of return for us. And so finally, I want to sort of wrap up this investment discussion by noting, it's not shown up here on the slide, but another element is of the state rail plan is an investment program. And again, it's not specific projects, but how we're coming forward with that is discussion of the types of investment categories, the priorities for public investment, and evaluation factors or criteria to demonstrate that we are seeing a public benefit from the types of benefits. And our committee has had some recent discussions on that, and bottlenecks have really floated to the top in terms of an area where they are showing a benefit in a lot of different objectives, efficiency, economic development, even safety in some cases. And so they have been prominent, and I expect them to be bottlenecks to be prominent moving forward in our conversations.
So how do we address bottlenecks? And I guess the short answer is we do the best we can with what we have. And the only areas where we've had resources to actually try to remove some of these has been through Connect Oregon. I'll give you a very good example here in just a second. We had an industrial rail spur fund, which was really kind of a predecessor to the Connect Oregon grant program. And that fund has currently been exhausted, but we used that strategically in certain areas as opportunities came up to remove critical choke points, particularly in eastern Oregon along with the Prineville Railroad. And we took advantage of federal stimulus money not to actually remove any bottlenecks, but we did start doing preliminary engineering and environmental clearance work on some critical bottlenecks that affect both freight rail but also our passenger rail system. So one of the best good news stories is the Harrisburg Bridge. I alluded to it earlier. As I said, it's a 30-mile-an-hour choke point on an otherwise completely improved track from Eugene to Albany. $4 million Connect Oregon grant leveraged $12 million of Union Pacific money. This is actively under construction and will be completed and open to traffic in October of next year. So good investment, good return, and I do want to point out that, yeah, this is private infrastructure, but I run passenger rail trains upon this section of track, and success is gained in minutes in passenger rail world, so I'm looking forward to this being open. A missed opportunity is the Willbridge crossovers in North Portland Junction. Since we have no available state money to service federal match, no ready source other than Connect Oregon, we miss opportunities that come along. And a Tiger grant, that's a transportation investment generating economic recovery grant, was available this past spring. We had the preliminary engineering work and environmental work completed and ready to go for one of these two junctions. We scrambled around. We worked with Union Pacific. Of course, they are a big bureaucracy just like we are. They were not able to complete the return on investment work that they needed to do in a timely fashion. We had no source of matching funds, and we let the opportunity slide. So,
how much was it?
$20 million.
And how much would we have had to put up?
20%. 20%, so $2 million.
And I have a question. And that improvement and a $20 million missed opportunity, the improvement would have involved jobs, I imagine. We would have been doing real on-the-ground work employing Oregonians.
Chair Benz, Representative Nason, that's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Sorry.
And that, with that salvo, I conclude my remarks.
What a way to go out.
Other questions for this panel?
Yes. So I have I find this interesting, this the choke point thing, and there's a person who rides the trains and have crossed the Harrisburg Bridge several times, but there's others between here. I can tell you I've ridden north and south, clear on the west coast, but within even Oregon, certainly going north, there's other, and I don't know, the choke point is decided by the condition of the bridge or facilities, or is decided by the design, because if I think when we cross the Columbia between Portland and Vancouver, the train slows substantially going across that bridge, and I'm never quite clear. So what are the issues? I mean, are there different issues? Or?
Representative Lively, it can be a variety of factors. Slow orders are generally caused by track condition, but they can also be caused by geometry. So, for example, the passenger rail trains are allowed to go 79 miles an hour. They're only able to cross will only be able to cross the Harrisburg Bridge once it's completed at 70 miles an hour, and that's because of an approaching curve.
That's what I was.
The issue with the bridge across the Columbia, you come out of a whole series of choke points there at the junctions, and then you move right into a station in Vancouver. So you're never really allowed to get up to full speed within that section of track. So the causes are various.
Great. Thank you.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to return to the topic of the rail plan for a minute. A couple of questions. When did we start working on it, and how long is it going to be from beginning to end?
Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson, our committee started meeting of January of this year. There was a little bit of pre-work that came along with the FRA grant to start the plan, but that's when we started meeting. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to have share the draft with our steering committee. We're thinking February. From there would go out for public to the commission, and ultimately out for public review and be adopted the middle of next year is our goal.
We do have a rail plan currently. And when was that done?
Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson, that we do, yes. The last rail plan, I believe, was 2001, and it certainly doesn't have the elements for it to be the federally required rail plan now. Those have happened since, and so there's significant reasons to update it for that.
And one last.
Sure.
I was pleased to hear you describe what will be some overarching ideas and concepts that are explained in the report. Well, I certainly hope that it has plenty of specific recommendations so that if there are opportunities, we have a to-do list that we can act on rather immediately. As we've heard about the Willbridge crossover, North Portland Junction, and with what was it, $800 million that the state of Washington got a few years ago, and we got less than 1% of, I think less than a half of a percent, which was a huge disappointment. It would be wonderful to know that we're just poised to take advantage of opportunities or even our own plans, that we're ready to go and can start putting people to work and making improvements for the future. So there will be plenty of specifics in there, too?
Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson. Yes, that's correct. That's very first and foremost in our mind to have that. We've been overall at ODOT trying to make our plans more actionable and strategic, and so we've got that moving forward as well. But at the investment program that I did mention, we'll have a short-term and a long-term section, and we can get much more specific in some of the short-term needs. And one of the ways that we'll be positioned to take advantage of those opportunities in the future is show that it is consistent with the rail plan's recommendations or needs as been identified as a high priority issue. So that is really one of the primary objectives of our project, is to position ourselves for that.
Thank you.
So to follow up on that line of thought, the issue is, let's use the $2 million, $20 million situation. How would we have shown, or how did we fail to show, the benefit that would have accrued to Oregon by virtue of its $2 million investment? But this is an issue that comes up all the time in Connect Oregon discussions. At the end of the day, we all want to invest more in these systems because on a broad scale, we want the infrastructure. But convincing the taxpayers to pay the money is the issue. So what is it that we're doing to show all the value that would have returned? I want to skip over the jobs, because we can throw $2 million out and have somebody dig a hole and fill it up for $2 million. the question is, what is that long term benefit, and how is your plan going to reflect it?
So, Representative Vince, using the example of the $20 million, that was an issue of timing. So that was a federal grant opportunity that came along, and there is no source of money currently within the state of Oregon that would allow us to meet that match in the time frames that we were given for the grant. So most transportation funding in this state is constrained by the Constitution to go onto highways. So investment in rail funds, investment in rail junctions, that's either a special effort, a special ask, or the way that we've been most successful is using the Connect Oregon process. But that's a grant process. It takes a pretty considerable amount of time.
But I understand that. But that's the process. What is the benefit? Let's pretend I'm in trying to get the money. How do I say we should spend $2 million?
I see.
What's the return to the state?
So there's several pieces. One, we do operate passenger rail service. Removal of these bottlenecks immediately benefit passenger rail by improving on-time performance, which is critical for providing that service. But I think in a much larger capacity, and some of the folks who are here to talk about rail, from the railroads, it's a huge economic drain if we're delaying, slowing down shipments, movements, if we're not able to be as efficient. And look what's playing out in the port right now with the concern of losing one of our big shippers. That's a timeliness issue, as been stated in the newspapers. So it's all about timeliness and efficiency and the economic return that is generated by the efficient movement of goods.
Oh, I agree with you, and I'm just asking, does the report say this?
Chair Benz, we're right now working on drafting the investment program, and that certainly is identified as a need that's going to be in the report, and part of the investment program is discussion of why that's a priority and what the benefits are, or what the evaluation factors are important for rail investments overall, and how is something like that showing that we're meeting the benefits moving forward. So I believe it is. Yeah.
Okay. Further questions for this panel? Yes, Representative.
One more. Along the lines of
permanent improvements for our economic climate and how can we support our state and regional economy. I'd like to hear a little bit about how the people participating in preparing the rail plan are discussing the types of products that are being shipped or could be shipped. For example, it's easy to talk about what exists and how to improve what exists, mm-hmm. but sometimes it's what you're not doing that you ought to think about. Right. And I have two specific examples in mind. One is a product manufactured in Oregon. The producer used to ship by rail, doesn't any longer mm-hmm. because of delays, not being able to count on meeting date and time requirements for shipping the product, and it arriving at a port in time basically to catch the ship that's going across the ocean, and it just wasn't working anymore, which was a real disappointment because the person wanted to continue to use rail but couldn't. So that's a product that maybe if we improved the situation, whether it's choke points, congestion generally or whatever, maybe that product would then be able to be shipped by rail again. Another is a product that has not been shipped by rail before, but maybe there's a potential of starting to be shipped by rail. Is the group thinking about those kinds of situations rather than just sort of improving the state of what is exactly today?
Yeah, Chair Pence, Representative Nathanson. Two things come to mind with that. Some of the technical elements of the state rail plan, one is a system inventory that talks about what's going on now. The second sort of companion piece is the needs assessment, and part of our needs assessment is really an opportunities assessment. And we took a look at the potential markets that are out there, whether that be population or industries in the area, and at least trying to provide some of the foundation for recognizing that there are opportunities to grow rail service and to benefit those communities and businesses in the area. So I think certainly it's part of our technical work, and we have members of the committee that are very interested in that as well.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. And we have Catherine, Patrick, and Martin, I hope. Would like to go first.
Okay. Just gonna let the PowerPoint load up. Chair Bentz, Vice Chair Gorsuch, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Catherine Williams. I'm the Business and Rail Affair Manager for the Port of Portland. Before I dive into the Port of Portland's newly published 2-inch-thick rail plan, I'd like to just spend a second or two talking about why rail planning is so important to the Port of Portland and really ports, I think, all around the state of Oregon. We, as well as other ports in Oregon, have benefited greatly from our collective investment in the statewide rail system. Since completion of the 2003 rail capacity study that really looked at some of the major choke points along the I-5 corridor, railroads of all sizes, both the class ones and the short lines, ports, private businesses, state and local agencies have made really huge investments in the system. And when we looked at the list of investments on the 2003 choke point study as we were getting ready to embark on our rail plan, we realized that many of those big ticket items, those big projects, had already been checked off the list, which was great news. We do, though, know that we have lots more work to do. 78% of the Port of Portland's marine traffic moves by rail. Quite simply, that is why we spend so much time thinking about the rail network. We know it's imperative for us to remove bottlenecks on the system to maintain our competitive advantage. Oh, I'm sorry, I've just noticed these aren't advancing. Let me try this way. There we go. The rail system serves as a gateway for us to have businesses have access to larger markets in the interior of the country. And since most of the cargo that moves through the port is what we call discretionary cargo, meaning it could shift to other gateways that are more cost competitive, it's imperative that we keep pace with changes in the freight rail industry. We're focused on maintaining our excellent rail access, particularly for unit train, which are longer single commodity trains, preserving an increasing capacity on the system for both local and long-haul moves, and looking at increased demand for intermodal yard service. Before I talk about the port rail plan, I do want to touch briefly on several recently completed projects that are right in the port's backyard. One is a grade-separated crossing, two are yard expansions, and one is a bypass project. The first is South Rivergate Rail Yard and Ramsey Rail Yard, two projects completed in 2012 for about $24 million. And both of those projects were really made possible in part by Connect Oregon funds. The second is the Ledbetter Overcrossing, which is a overcrossing adjacent to the gate at Terminal 6, which is our container terminal in Rivergate. And this project allows the BNSF greater fluidity, which is reducing delay for multiple businesses within the Rivergate Industrial District. The St. John's Lead, right outside of the Terminal 4 rail yard where Toyota's facility is, was also a Connect Oregon project. So the objective of the port's rail plan was to identify future freight demand, challenges, and opportunities for the port's customers and tenants. We compared forecasted demands, business opportunities, and challenges to the capability of the existing infrastructure, and then identified infrastructure improvements necessary to meet the demands, opportunities, and challenges. And I just want to note that although this plan is really focused on the freight side of the equation, we recognize at the port that both the freight and passenger rail networks are interconnected and must be planned accordingly to meet both freight and passengers' needs. It's really, truly an integrated network. The tool that we use to evaluate the system is called the Line Occupancy Index. And basically what that is you take a segment of track and you calculate it by dividing the minutes per day the track is occupied by the total minutes per day. And then you put those segments into three buckets. And we did that for two time periods. We did that for current day, 2020 and 2030. What we've found is today the system is largely operating with good capacity with some constraints in the region, and Mr. Gard touched on some of those major choke points. One is Penn Junction leading to the East Portland segment on the UP line, and Wishram, which is actually in the state of Washington, but the geographic region that we studied for our rail plan goes east to Troutdale, south to actually Eugene, and north into southwest Washington. The green on the map, and again, I can provide this whole document to all of you. We could have a disk, put it on a disk, or send you the link so you can delve into the details of the line occupancy index. But the green shows segments that are below practical capacity, yellow is approaching practical capacity, and red is exceeding practical capacity. So we found that in 2020, the system's really in fairly good shape with no line segments over capacity, but several are becoming more capacity constrained. So if they're green, they're sort of turning shades of yellow. If they're yellow, they're sort of bleeding into red. Segments that were almost kind of on that border between yellow and red were the Kenton Line, the Penn Junction, and again, Wishram. In 2030, however, four line segments are over capacity. So it's really that time frame between 20 and 30 that we really have to start paying attention to. So the net result was that we...
Hold on a second.
Yes. This will be very quick.
Yes.
You mentioned we need to be concerned about that period between 2020 and 2030. How far in advance does one start planning for an improvement to be completed, let's say, by 2024, so you don't reach the point where you've exceeded capacity? Does it take 2 years, 10 years?
Chair Bentz, Representative Nathanson, that's a great question. We start planning now. The kinds of investments, the right-of-way implications, some of the reason that line turns from yellow to red is a double track need on the Kenton line, which is miles and miles of railroad. And the Union Pacific understands this better than we do, and they are looking at that line. But that will take decades. And I should have noted before I flip switches, this is assuming really no new investment is made. Mm-hmm. So this is what we know on the books today is either funded, planned or funded. Actually, planned is the wrong word. Really preliminary engineering to funding. So this is something we have the ability, obviously, to change.
And Ms. Williams, while we have you stop, if you could push the microphone away so you stay about 6 inches away from it, it works better.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yep. So we identified 29 infrastructure projects in the plan. 18 were within or near the port. 6 were on the main line in the Portland area, and 5 were on the main line in the Washington area. And those 29 projects totaled about $580 million. There are quite a diverse set of projects, everything from maintenance and repair projects to yard improvements, grade separation projects, paving unpaved areas of intermodal yard where truck and rail are connecting to make cargo transfers, access improvement projects for both the main line and terminals, direct connections that don't exist. I mentioned the double tracking. And even in some cases, we identified projects associated with ventilating tunnels.
Can you go back to that? The $580 million was what?
The 29 infrastructure projects that we identified as part of our rail plan.
That you need. Are they in process or you want them?
Representative Benz, they're something we need.
Okay.
They're not in process.
Okay.
And of those projects, I thought I would just quickly highlight one of them because it's sort of a unique project and also not unique at all. It is the North Rivergate Boulevard grade separation. And we all know that at-grade rail crossings can be significant bottlenecks and have implications on both the road and rail system, particularly at the community level, as blocked rail crossings cause delay for both vehicles and trucks, in addition to sometimes railroads. One project we had identified in our rail planning process is an at-grade crossing in the Rivergate Industrial District that would grade separate a crossing at Rivergate Boulevard, which provides rail access to Terminal 5. Over half the tonnage that is exported out of the entire Portland Harbor crosses this rail lead. And right now, sometimes, because these trains are getting longer and there are many safety requirements that the Class 1s are complying with, air testing, safety, when they're building these long trains, the crossing can be blocked for 30 minutes a couple of times a day, but we've had times when the crossing's been blocked for 4 hours. And this is causing not only challenges for the railroads and the shippers that they're serving within Rivergate, but it's causing major problems along the road network. And this particular road network is located in the largest industrial district in the state of Oregon, so most of the vehicles that are experiencing delay are trucks, which are very high-value trips. So we've been, I like to say, very scrappy about how we've looked to solve this problem. We, too, looked at the most recent federal Tiger program and put together an application with the City of Portland and Metro that included this. We were unfortunately not successful, but we are continuing to look at all sources of funding that come along to address this type of at-grade crossing. And that's it for my formal remarks, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thanks.
I think we'll wait until if someone has a question as we're going along, say so. In fact, I do have one. So 590.
Okay.
$590 million.
Representative Benz.
And this goes back to our the conversation just a few minutes ago, which was why should we invest it? I mean, it's over half a billion. What good is going to come to Oregon as a result of investing it? And this is, we have this conversation a lot in my small towns. Why should we put a new road in John Day if no one's there? No one's going to use it. Why are we doing it? And so the question would be, if we put half a billion into the port, does that guarantee we're going to have a lot more business? Or does it just maintain what we have? What's somewhere in your plan, is there a big pot of gold at the end of the investment rainbow? That's what I'm asking.
Representative Benz, we have a business case for these types of investments. And, for example, the project that I just mentioned to grade separate that at-grade crossing would be between $10 and $14 million. Hasn't been scoped, but that's a good rough estimate. That is needed because Canpotex and Columbia Grain are investing hundreds of millions of dollars in their facilities to the north, and they're expanding, which is a great economic development story. And I think we could make the same kinds of connections between most of the projects on our list. We did an extensive amount of interviews with shippers, customers, the class ones, the short lines, around each project to develop a business case. When our properties folks are showing potential new businesses property inside Rivergate, most of them want to know if it's rail served. They want that mode to be able to develop their site. So we feel really good about saying that these kinds of investments are going to lead to better business, economic development, taxes, all of that for the state.
And the same case is being made for John Day, just so anyone knows.
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
Anyway, go ahead. I'll
follow up on that for a moment. A few years ago, I can't remember the date, I've asked for it several times, and I've received the answer several times. There was an article in probably an AOI magazine that discussed transportation, and it included discussion of rail traffic and rail congestion, and there was information about the cost of congestion, the cost to business, and what happens when there's a delay for an hour or a half a day, or when a company even has to stop production for a day or two because they can't get their products onto the trucks that are taking them onto the trains. So it even backs up to stopping production at a facility because they can't get the stuff out of the building. So I would like it if we could find one of those short papers that talked about the cost of congestion, whether it's mentioned by hour or by truck that can't make it onto a train because of, you know, whatever reason. It was pretty interesting to see the dollars that are attributed to that, and this was a major factor in years ago when the business community came together and initiated what has now culminated in the Columbia River Crossing project. It was initiated by the business community saying there is serious congestion costing us real dollars and we need to solve it.
Representative Benz, I actually know the article that you're talking about. I think Representative Nathan said it was actually written by Annette Price, my colleague at the Port of Portland. It was called something like Roads, Rivers, Rails, and Runways, and it cited both the statewide cost of congestion report, but a series of interviews that were done around the state, or all over the state, of businesses who use rail, air cargo, and we can certainly get you a copy of it if...
I'd like to have an electronic copy,
okay,
please.
We can do that.
I have a paper copy in a folder. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Kerr. I'm the Assistant Vice President of Government Affairs for Genesee and Wyoming. I'm also wearing a second hat today as a president of the O-Rule Foundation, our association, the Oregon Rail Users League. Thank you for the opportunity to come up and visit with you guys a bit about this. Some of the things from the shoreline perspective is what I'm going to bring out. I hope to cite a couple examples and then answer some questions. I've handed out a little bit of information, and I'm not going to read that verbatim because I figured you guys can do that and follow up on that. What I'd like to do is a couple things, is let you know 100% of our business moves by rail, so we're very interested in that, obviously. Short lines actively pursue what historically the class ones disinvested in their franchises for the rail, because it was just not profitable. The customers that just weren't high enough on the priority that they wouldn't serve them, or they price them out of the market. That's historically what happened. That's nothing we can change or do. The shorelines came about because of that. We took over these rail lines that had been disinvested 20 years before we got them, and in a lot of cases the shoreline industry where they exist now, if it wasn't for the short line coming in and taking that over, these rural communities, these areas, these customers would have no rail access now. And so we prolonged that 30 years or more and invested heavily in there. All of our money comes from our own investments that we do, the freight that we move. We have to pay for all of our maintenance, very labor and capital intensive. As you guys well know, you understand from the passenger trains and whatnot. It's been said that Oregon is a garden hose between two fire hydrants, being Washington and California. If that's true for freight, it is. If that's true, then the short lines are the garden hose between the customer and the class one, and the duct tape just won't fix it. Things, programs like Connect Oregon are very, very important and vital to short lines as ourselves, because that allows us to bring our private money to bear and to leverage that with the state in a partnership, not just something to give us some money, we'll go see if we can build some. It's a partnership because we are that connection to the rural communities, to these areas that have no access to the national rail network. And in a lot of these cases, the employers, these large and small employers in these communities, without them, we don't have a job, but without us handling the business, those industries don't have a place to ship to. And so we want to make sure that we are the connection to the outside world, to these people. Some of the things, and I want to try to be a little bit specific on them, are our choke points. I listened to what Mr. Gard said, that the junctions, speed restrictions, yard issues, interchange sidings, those are some of the bottlenecks, and we couldn't agree more. What does that look like from a short line perspective? I'll give you a couple for instances on these. The last Connect Oregon 4, we put in for an application on the Corp line going south of Roseburg into the Medford Valley. We put in for the tunnel enhancements. Those tunnels out there were built in the 1800s. They are not big enough to handle the high-capacity rail cars that are out there today. So we put that in at the request of our customers and in the request of the 8 local agencies in there to partner and come in and notch out the tunnel so they can get the latest, greatest rail cars, the higher capacity, so they can compete in accounts that are outside of their current market, and keep profitable. That was a very big success. We're getting close to going out to bid on that and moving forward. So that's something that we look at. If you look up things that we look at that are also pinch points and bottlenecks are like in-street trackage, where we run right down the middle of the street. We have some in rural communities like Junction City, Harrisburg. We have stuff in Rainier, where we have to take these trains and go through these communities at 10 miles an hour, whether it's a 10-car train or it's a 120-car unit train, and we understand that. And the safety around that and the issues that we have moving these commodities safely dictates that we go at a slow speed. We've looked at it 100 years ago, 50 years ago when these locations were put into play and started. The trains are smaller. The cars were less. You had yard capacity where you had a 50-car yard was enough for what you needed. Now a 50-car yard won't even hold one train. You have these locations where it was okay because the traffic wasn't such an issue. Now you get to places like Highway 30 where it's a race into town, it's a race back out, up and down I-5. So we do have issues where we're pinned in against a highway and a river or in between these locations, these mountains, that we just can't expand our capacity. And so it's very important for us to be able to have a safe, efficient interchange of goods between our customers and the market. If we don't have that, we're not going to be able to provide our service. Why does that matter? It's a pebble in a pond. You throw a pebble and those ripple effects. You were talking about that earlier. Something that happens, the delay that happens, let's say, at Springfield Junction in Eugene area could have a major effect by the time the traffic gets to Chicago. It could be 6 weeks late. Why? Because there was an issue there that just caused a backup going forward. I'll talk about Eugene here in just a second. One of the things that's very interesting with the way the rail has had a resurgence. Okay, in 2006, 2007, it was booming, and it just took a tank. We see that. Our railroads itself, our two railroads, you have the Portland and Western, we have the Corp. The Portland Western had 120,000 cars there running a year. The Corp had 50-something thousand. Right now, the Corp has a little over 20,000 carloads that they're handling safely, efficiently. Portland and Western has about 70,000 or so. So you can see that the balance has dropped. But it doesn't mean that we can run faster. It doesn't mean that we can handle more cars, because we still are at these choke points where we can't interchange freely and more efficiently. Specifically in Eugene, it's a unique area. You have five different railroads using one area. You have the Portland and Western, you have the Corp, you have the Coos Bay rail line coming into Eugene. You have the Union Pacific Yard. They have the big Class 1. We all interchange with them. And they also host the Amtraks. And if there is an issue bringing on the line that comes in from the Coos Bay, you have four railroads using that. You have the Corp, the Portland and Western, you have the Coos Bay, and you have the Union Pacific at the same time using them. And it's one track. How do you get around that? How do you service that? How do you get that? How do you be able to get his traffic to ours and vice versa? We have to go into the yard. The yard is constrained because they don't have enough capacity. It's not that that's not big enough. It's been around for a long time. It just needs to be relooked at. How can we do that efficiently so we can interchange with our partners? That's the Union Pacific in that area. The neat thing about this, the line down in that area, that we also interchange with the BNSF. We are the agent for them. So this first mile, last mile that the short lines have, sometimes is 120 miles long. We go from Vancouver and we take that traffic off the BN and we take it all the way down to Eugene. If we can't efficiently handle that, and we're getting into a point where we're not able to do that, because we just don't have the capacity on the sidings, the yard tracks, to be able to sort that mail out, as I like to call it, build the blocks, go serve our customers. We get to a point where we can't do that in that yard or that area. We've got to take our car loads, take them up to Albany, switch them out, and bring them back. Well, all that does is it delays the customer's traffic. It adds congestion. It adds emissions to the area. These are things that we don't want to do. These are all the benefits of rail that we like to take advantage of. All the heavy shipments that we can take out, reducing emissions, efficiencies. That's something that we can't do. We can't pass that on to our customers and do what we're designed to do. It has a heavy effect. We're talking, Representative talked about bridges. We echo that. We understand that there is issues out there with these long-term investments that have been out there. This infrastructure has been out there for 100-plus years, and it's doing fantastic shape for what it is. But unlike the highway system that's fairly new, in comparison, has been rebuilt a lot of times. Our railroads haven't been rebuilt. We just don't have the mechanisms to do that ourselves. We try. We work with things like Connect Oregon, other partnerships, other opportunities. We stand ready for that. But we have a hard time being able to deliver those on our own, just because of the way that the system works here. It's just very, very difficult when you're over bridges or over water, or you have a major metropolitan areas that you have to go through. It's very difficult as you're going through these locations to see, because you have the growth around the railroads. Mm-hmm. If you're in the middle of nowhere, as we are in some of our tracks, it's the only thing out there. If you don't have access, you don't have an area that's going to be able to grow and develop, and the economic and industrial development that the railroad brings to these communities, to these locations, the hope and idea of that will be lost, and we won't be able to capture that. The rail is kind of a balance. I look at it. If you look down a rail line, you don't know what's at the end of it. You're not sure. But those two rails balance something. That's the stewardship, the environmental stewardship that we have to our state and everything else, and the economic development that we have. We don't have a balance between them. We can't run these things. If we have a balance, then we can have an opportunity at the end of the line. I don't like to look behind us and see the rail picked up. As soon as the rail's picked up, it's hard to bring it back. You're not building any more property. You're not building any more areas. So how do we not just preserve it for today, but how do we preserve it in such a way that we can grow and offer the abilities to our partners as we go down that road? If we don't have that ability, these choke points will literally exhaust all of our opportunities. So I'll let go.
Representative Nixon.
Well, something was mentioned that really gets me curious. I'd like to make sure I understood what you said, and maybe you could even paint a more specific picture for me. Did I understand correctly that you referred to it's sort of like sorting mail. This needs to go this direction and this needs to go that direction. You have cars that you need to do something with, and if you can't do that at the Eugene Yard, you take everything to Albany to sort it and come back? Could you repeat that if I got it wrong?
No, you got it right. If we're not at that point yet, but we are close. We have small infrastructure. Like I said, we have short tracks, maybe a three-track yard, where we can sort out these boxcars and put them in certain areas. That's above and beyond where the cars that we're bringing down and taking out and classifying different ways. So if we can't do it efficiently in this area because there's just not enough room, we're going to have to take it and go up to a place that we do have the room and then bring it back down and then go ahead and deliver the mail, as you say. So you're correct in what you're
So, brief follow-up. Thank you. So, just like the Port of Portland has done a study with, you know, a 2-inch thick or more than 2 inches book about and anticipating the future, and there's the green and the yellow and the red lines. Have you done some thinking about at what point? You're not the only one using that yard. As you pointed out, there are actually five. There's Coos Bay, Corp, PNW, Amtrak, and UP all using that place. So you don't probably have all the information that you would need, but have you thought about at what point do you think the capacity would be insufficient for you to work there?
We have. We don't have a report like that, but we do have our own internal data that we look at constantly and see that determines our long-range plans, our next 5 years. What are we doing next year? What's our capital investments we can put in? Because we are for-profit and we do have to reinvest in our track, and we do that gratefully, we have to pick and choose what's the best project at the right time with the right amount of funding. When we have these projects, as we're coming up with the next Connect Oregon, we look at that and say, what is the best thing to do with the money we have to try to leverage to do something that we couldn't do now? We look to our partners to do that, whether it's the Union Pacific or somebody else, to enhance the yard capacity or whatnot. I know the port's working on some stuff out there on their side of the line and working that we can more efficiently interchange. That's stuff that we ongoing, because this is our business. And part of it is that the outlook, whether it's 20 years out and you look at it now, because that time flies by, as we come up, but what can we do now, and what's the right thing for the near future, and that and to handle that capacity? And we are talking to our partners. Do we have solid plans and everything lined out? No, because there is some flex and some flow to some of these things because of the traffic may be seasonal. Some of the traffic may be just is it just coming online, or is it something different? So we do have to be positioned to react differently when the times are appropriate.
In terms of the capacity issues that you were talking about, and so you have a lot of single track, is your company in a position where they have enough right of way that if the money was there, they could, for instance, add more sidings and things like that, or is it a fairly narrow right of way for your system?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is both. We do have some areas that we do have ample right of way. And we are prepared to put that capacity in there where we can. A couple of things you have to look at is road crossings, rivers, bridges, creeks. Where do we have enough property, and in the state of Oregon, there's a it rains once in a while here, so there's a lot of water. And just like the Coos Bay has about 20 miles over water over there, we have a lot on ours as well. So getting it to the right location to where you can build, so I'm not having to go over another a bridge over another body of water that takes the permitting and issues that have, or I'm not cutting blocking a crossing because I'm stretched out too long. And so to find a spot that's 5,000 to 8,000 foot long that I can chamber a train either to pass or store or whatnot in the right areas is something that we've looked at and will continue to do, but those are the challenges that we face. Okay.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. And so let's say you did a 5,000 foot piece. Approximately how much does that cost to do that?
It all depends on if it's fill or not. You have to look at a mile of rail is roughly almost $500,000 to,
really?
To put in, yeah. And that's non-signaled. That's not switches. So you have switches on either end that you have to do. If it's on a signalized line, you have a little bit more work, embankment, that type of stuff. So 5,000 foot gets you a small train too. You don't have much room to get in there.
Right.
And a lot of the trains that we have, because we were 30% or so less on traffic over the last few years, we have some room to grow that, but we're still fixed on the length because our trains are still long enough. We don't want to take 40 cars when I can take 60 or 80 cars long. So I want to make sure I don't have to go back up to Albany to get more traffic. I want to make sure I have it all in one shot, and that dictates having enough capacity to fit that whole thing out of the way so we can utilize it.
One more?
Sure.
I'm just following in your footsteps, Representative. In terms of, now, does your line also serve Forest Grove? Because I don't mean to ask you, but in Forest Grove, there's a very long stretch of rail that goes right down the middle of the street. And so it sounds very much like some of the others that you've described. Do you tend to have community acceptance of that? I mean, we just recently saw the Union Pacific go to No Horns out here and all of that. I just wondered how much of a pushback you get, you know, as people have moved into these neighborhoods and there's more and more people. Has it been a problem for you?
It is. And it doesn't have to be a place where we're running down the middle of the street. You can look at locations where we have, say we have a switching area. I'm going to use Linton for an example, right? It's out of Portland. We have a bunch of customers out there. That's where we switch our tracks. That's also where we interchange with the BNSF. We have everything going on and shoehorning it into what we have there. We also have about 7 crossings within a mile. So that 7 crossings, I by law have to blow the horn as I'm going through there. The increase of traffic, more cars that are there, I have to switch. I have to move things around. That's my location that I have to do it. And so I do get complaints from the residents saying, you're blowing the horns too loud. You're doing this. Why are you doing this? The clanging. So those things happen. Some of the things that they don't realize, we're trying to be good partners and talk to them. The locomotive horns. Some of the newer locomotive horns are just louder. They're pointed different. They're a different style versus you press a button and it goes off. There's no feathering it back lightly or not. Some of the older locomotives have an air horn that has a little bit less decibels. That we don't encourage our people to not blow the horn or anything. By federal law, we have to. So we do have community pushbacks for that, and we try to address those. Part of it is we are stuck and confined in an area that's all we have, and we realize that, but we do have to still do our jobs.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Port of Coos Bay.
Chair Benz, Co-Chair Gorsuch, members of the committee. I'm Martin Callery, Chief Commercial Officer for the Port of Coos Bay. We, as a port district, own the Coos Bay Rail Line, which is operated as Coos Bay Rail Link. I also serve on the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, the Southwest Area Commission on Transportation, and O'Rule, and I don't know how many others, which keeps me away from the office probably more than my boss would like. I think you've heard a lot about constraints, and 4 or 5 years ago, I would have agreed with everything that was said. I've had a baptism of railroad over the last 5 years, and I think that we need to move more to a system approach. And one of the reasons I say that, and I think a good example of that, is the City of Prineville Railway. Great little railroad, only 18, 19 miles long, but it suffered from the fact that it didn't really have facilities to have an intermodal transfer point. And through Connect Oregon, both, or actually all three, Connect Orion 1, 2, and 3, they built an outstanding set of facilities over there that now is encouraging greater use of the system. They're handling commodities that had not run on the rail for a long time because they've been able to find that interchange point. So to me, without that, that here again, that's another system constraint. You've heard tunnels, you've heard bridges, all of those kind of things. We face all of those same issues on the Coos Bay rail line. Right now we have a preliminary draft rail plan, a long-term plan. It's based on a couple of projects that we're looking at that would involve interchange to marine commerce. And as Patrick has said, you know, you have to find the right place to put in a unit train siding, but you also have to, in our case, we have to plan for something to handle the manifest traffic, the shorter trains that are handling, you know, five boxcars for this guy and four chip cars for this guy and all of this kind of thing. So you have to balance those investments. Now, one of the things that I also think needs to be looked at in the system is, if you recall, when the Southern Pacific was absorbed into the Union Pacific, Union Pacific decided to rationalize their facilities at the Eugene Yard, and they pulled out thousands of feet of track. Well, now they're facing a situation in that facility where they have told all of the short lines that interchange there, can't do it anymore in our yard. So the Port of Coos Bay is investing in a 2,300-foot siding outside of the yard, west of the UP yard, and we will interchange with Corp and PNW, and then it's also being leveraged by another investor who will take a spur off of our line and have an transfer point for a variety of commodities, both moving from the coast and moving to the coast. So those are the kind of things that we have to look at in the short line industry. We have to look at every opportunity. I mean, it's very much the result of the Oregon legislature really understanding now and starting to understand how critical rail is to the state's traded sector economy. You know, we started out back in October 2011 with a little bit of train service. We moved 194 cars. We thought, well, okay, it's a start. So first full year, 2012, we ran 2,480 cars. We're going to double it in 2013. And it's because there was pent up demand and a refreshening of the economy. But here again, you know, things that I had thought, you know, we're not going to have that issue on the Coos Bay rail line. Yes, we have constraints. We're trying to find an interload or an interchange point for trucking in the area. We're handling commodities that hadn't been on that rail line in years. Organic dairy feed for organic farms in the Coquille Valley. They want an interchange point. They don't want to have to come up to Coos Bay with their trucks and move it from a hopper car into their trucks to take it to the Coquille Valley. So we have to find other places. You know, we're going to work with other places that have rail infrastructure connected to the Coos Bay line, and we're going to try and leverage off of that so we continue to build traffic. But I think my main message really is we have to look beyond talking about rail choke points and rail bottlenecks and look at how those bottlenecks are then impacting the highway system or the marine system, because we have to focus on the system. And the system is really what is driving things now. It's not individual modes. It's all tied together, and the failure in one mode is going to lead to challenges in other modes. So I'm not going to repeat what has been said before, but I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions for the Coos Bay? No, no questions.
You.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Your last statement is extremely timely. It seems so important to me. A failure in one mode leads to challenges in other modes, indeed. And as we've put lots of investments in, I think most of our constituents still probably focus on
highway or road or highway bridge improvements, because that's what they see. They're not aware of what we've done to make improvements in a port or a rail or, you know, the other modes. So I think it's our job to make sure we keep telling the story so people understand the connection. But I am curious about a couple of things you mentioned. For example, what would be the reason why thousands of feet of track would be removed? I know why one, there was one it's a very short piece of rail in the city of Eugene that it was some right-of-way that there was a siding that led to an industrial site that was no longer used. It was in the sort of nearly downtown area, and there was permission asked to remove the rail and give up the right-of-way, and I objected at the time, saying, we may need it. Why would you ever give up something that could come back into use? But this is intriguing to me. Why would you pull up track that wasn't used? Is it a safety hazard, for example?
Representative Benz, or Chair Benz, Representative Nathanson, I can't speak for Union Pacific. I've had conversations with some of their people, and I know that at the time they were looking at their system, and they thought, okay, we've got a big yard in Roseville, California. We've got a big yard in Hinkle, Oregon. We've got facilities in the Portland metro area. We do have some other capacity within the system. We don't need all of this capacity in Eugene. And, you know, it was a decision, a strategic decision they made at that time. I think hindsight being what it is, they probably would have rethought that had they seen what Corp has done with the, even with the downturn that the traffic Corp generates. The traffic hopefully will continue to generate on the Coos Bay line. And, you know, one of the things you talked to, you mentioned, or someone mentioned at some point, how the system works. I mean, when we move all these cars, all these revenue cars, we're effectively taking those truckloads off the highway system. And to give you an idea, for the period of time we've been operating, which is just over 24 months, we've removed 742,000 tons of commodity from the highway system. And in our area, that would have been on the highway system because we had no rail. So there's another part of that system that we have to consider. What the benefits are to other components.
You got another question? Well, we really appreciate... Any other questions? Really appreciate the time you've taken in giving us this information. I must say, the truckers may not be wildly enthusiastic about your success, but the but it does illustrate the value of having competing modes of transportation. But what I found most interesting from your presentation is the difficulty in measuring the other values that a short line rail or rail in general bring to a community. Mm-hmm. And we use the normal tools of jobs and this and that, but the point that was mentioned by Mr. Kerr about the growth of a small community or the survival of a small community while it waits maybe for something really interesting to happen is hard to measure. So we appreciate you bringing that before us, and thank you so much. And with that, Patrick, are we...
That's our agenda, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so that's our agenda, and we are adjourned.